Okay, so we are back for our second part of this series called The Process of Psach, which is really an important part of our life, our identity as Jews. And this is going to be one of our favorites because it is where Machloikas comes from. Machloikas is something that is all very dear and near to us in the Jewish community. And so we're trying to appreciate this in fuller context. I'd like to start off by thanking Shelley Dorfman and Mail, who are sponsoring this morning's learning together as we mark, just coming up, the second yahrzeit of Mr. Ephraim Grimet of blessed memory, Ephraim ben Yaakov David Olav HaShalom, whose presence in our shul was a significant and positive contribution to our community so many times. He was always with us in shul, always such a positive force, and so many of us knew him from before as well, and really appreciated him and his family in our shul. He let his memory always be a blessing, Be'ezras Hashem, and he should be a melitz yosha for the mishpacha here. For all those who are here in this space, it should be with continued blessing, Be'ezras Hashem, and he should have an aliyas neshama. What we're going to try to address this morning are a number of questions, some basic questions, and there's so much to talk about, there's so much to learn. Let's try to do it together, Be'ezras Hashem. And so we'll start off with a few questions, and that is, like, why are the rabbis always arguing? So another question we could ask is how can we say that we have common practice if we have so much dispute? This is like a question sometimes you hear people are struggling with faith. They say, like, everything in Judaism is a dispute. So, like, how do we know what we're going to do? How do we know anything is right? If everything seems to be a machlokas. So sometimes we will also say, where did it all start? Like, what was the first machlokas? Why is machlokas continuing? Why didn't they resolve it? And are there any positive aspects of machlokas besides the jokes? So we have to try and look at some of these ideas. There's so much to talk about. Let's start at the very beginning. So we want to start off just to frame it with a quotation that Rav Kook said in his book called Shmona Kvatzim, lesser known of his books. It's just such a beautiful idea to frame our learning today. And he says the following. He says, "B'inyanei ha-de'ot v'ha-emunot," in the realm of belief and faith, which are based on ethereal and conceptual ideas. When you live in the realm of ideas, then you're going to have argument. And you find two people who may be completely from one extreme to the other, different from one another. And really, in a deeper look, you'll realize they're actually saying the same thing. You find an argument just burning till the seat of heaven. And the reason of machlokes is simply in language, it is in linguistics. It's external, it's not internal. So whenever we deal with machlokes, Rav Kook sort of call it wholesome look and spiritual, we call it broad look, is that we're really just quibbling about details. If we really understood each other, we wouldn't be arguing. Let that be a framework, and that's the way he dealt with people. That's the way he diffused situations, is because he didn't take it too seriously. He didn't get caught in externalities or divisions, rather internalities of the integration. That's where it was. So the story goes, it was like one of these days, these complicated days in the Jewish calendar. And let's say it's Erev Pesach Sheni, you know, one of these days, and it's one of these communities in Eastern Europe, and they come to the discussion about Tachlin. So half the community says, we don't say Tachlin. We never ever said Tachlin. This is not the way to do things. And half the community says, we do say Tachlin, and they start having a machlokes. Now, in these things, I always smile to myself because the amount of time it takes to have the dispute and then to talk about why the rabbi doesn't know what he's talking about and how we did it last year, and then after shul to continue, is way longer than the 15 seconds it would have taken to say tachanun or not to say tachanun in the first place. But nonetheless, it's a matter of principle, of course. And so what happens is that the communities are getting into this great dispute. We always say tachanun, we never say tachanun. They come over to the rabbi, they say, Rabbi, he says, so the one group says, Rabbi, is it our minag to do tachanun? And the rabbi says it's not. So the other group says, is it our minhag not to do tachanun? He says, it's not. He says, what is our minhag? He says, to have a machlokas. And sometimes that's just the way it is. So let's try to dig it back a little bit into this. Every year the same thing happened. So where does it come from? So it turns out the first time we talk about dispute in general goes all the way back to Ma'ase Bereishis. In fact, if you look at the 7 days of creation, all the 7 days of creation, thank you so much, all the 7 days of creation have a appellation, a description which says Ki Tov. It was good, except for day number two. Why day number two? Day number two, says the Medrash, is because that was the day where there was division. Division between what? Between the upper waters and the lower waters, and therefore when there's division, it's not Ki Tov. It's not good. It's not 100% good. And the Medrash goes on to so far to say, and if this is a necessary division, and it's not Ki Tov, then unnecessary division, that's definitely not Ki Tov. That's not good as well. It's also worthwhile noting it's on day two, where you move from a unit to expansion, right? So the idea of moving from singularity to expansion, that is the place where machlokes, where division comes to be found. It's interesting to note, just as a fascinating observation, there is division on day one too. Did you notice that? Right, so there's division between light and dark, but that doesn't warrant the removal of Ki Tov. You know why? Because they're different, and it's necessary. It's obvious there's a difference between light and dark. When it comes to water and water, not so obvious. Maybe a different phase, right? This one's gas. This one's liquid. But it's not so obvious as to why they're so different. That kind of dispute over there, that warrants the lack of Ki Tov. And sometimes, so many times in our arguments are not black and white. They're not light and dark. They're water and water. They might just be different phases. So it's worthwhile thinking about where the removal of Ki Tov belongs. That's how far back it goes. It's almost as if what the Midrash is trying to tell us is somehow embedded into the very nature of creation is division. And that's really what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that is true about human beings. Why? Because it says, the Midrash describes, Kashem she'en partzufeihem doymoy zu lazu. Just as people's faces are not similar, look at the contours of a face. And I'm sure we've all had that person that they say, oh, we're just an immediate lookalike, and then we find that person and we're not like them at all, right? We look completely different. Well, that if that's true externally, then in the emotional makeup, we're certainly different to people, and therefore we are going to have very different opinions to issues. And I would actually say, if you go back to Rav Kook's observation, because the nation of Israel is a nation which lives in the realms of ideas, right? We don't live by the sword. We don't establish empires. We live in the book. We live in the realm of ideas. And the more you live in the realm of ideas, the more there is difference in the ideas that we have. We're sophisticated. We've got sensitivities. We're a complex people. And because we live in that realm, that's why there's so many differences of opinion. So much so that these are all famous things, but the Mishnah tells us in Pirkei Avos that the Mishnah tells us, so that there are types of machlokes which are good and types which are not good. The ones which are for the sake of heaven, ones which are not for the sake of heaven. What's a machlokes? It's Shem Shemaim. So by the way, it should be noted that L'shem Shemaim clearly is a reference to day two of creation. Right, that should be obvious to us when the Mishnah is talking about that. That's when the first machlokes happened. But that's clearly a subtext, but just worthwhile knowing that the Mishnah is not just using this phrase as a throwaway. But what's a machlokes she L'shem Shemaim? So it says Hillel and Shammah. We have to think about what that means, because Hillel and Shammah are going to be critical players when it comes to machlokes. But the machlokes she and L'shem Shemaim is Korach v'Hadassah. You notice, by the way, the interesting thing about that machlokes is that there's no second side to the argument. Did you notice that? Right, Moshe isn't in. It should be Moshe and Korach, right? But Moshe wasn't engaged. It was Korach and his folks. It could have been Drin, as the Chasam Sofer says in this Mishnah, that when you have a machlokes, which is Shelo L'shem Shemaim, all the folks on the one side actually are arguing with each other. They just have a common ill, right? So they have a rebellion. So they don't even have unity in terms of themselves. There's a lot to talk about here. I'd like to just close this little piece over here with Rav Yehuda Amitel's, the Rosh Hashiva Gush's observation, where he says that whenever people are arguing and they say it's a matter of principle, then that machlokes is never going to end. Because they're going to say, I'm arguing for L'shem Shemayim. I'm arguing, this is not about me. This is about the principle. And then when you argue about the principle, that machlokes never ends. It's going to go on for many, many, many generations if you're arguing based on principle. That's the we'll call it the opposite of what the Mishnah is saying.
The phrase Shemayim is a contraction of Eishumayim. So again, the two dimensions.
Beautiful.
So that fits
the opposites
as well, right?
Very good.
And yet they gotta coexist.
Beautiful. Exactly. So this is a little bit of a introduction to arguments in general. And so I would say the argument itself is not something that we invented. I think it's a state of being of a human being, is the fact that we see things differently. I always marvel. Marriage itself is quite an amazing thing. Here you take people who really have grown up with different cultures, perspectives, backgrounds, emotional makeups, parents, environments, and you put them together and somehow they're going to try to figure things out. It's a miracle every single time. I mean, how much work needs to go into the fact that people can work together and operate on such a level, multiple tiers of partnership, financial partnership, emotional partnership, physical partnership, financial, there's so much going on. And people manage to work together. That's a pretty significant miracle because there's so much different. There's so much difference between people and it takes a lot of work. And so the same is true about all human beings. Is that we are simply different, and therefore we're going to argue. So they say, okay, so how do we govern societies? Like, how does Torah work exactly? Especially considering that God gave us the Torah. A certain part of the Torah, we have the capacity to manipulate or to change or to develop, as we talked about last week, in terms of the development of Torah Shebaal Peh. And if that's the case, then you're essentially giving an argumentative creature, right, the ability to argue about these ideas. But these ideas are very significant and affect our day-to-day practice. So how does that work precisely? There needs to be a system. And the answer is there is a system. And there was a system. In fact, when we look at dispute, we have to look at it in two completely different phases of Jewish history. The first phase of Jewish history, in fact, there was very little dispute in action. What does that mean in action? That means to say that there was very little dispute as to what the practice was. Why? So the Rambam explains, and this is so critical to our understanding of Judaism, especially those who think that everything's a machlokes, because it isn't. The Rambam says in the beginning of Hilchos Mamrim, it's worthwhile learning and appreciating this observation. He says, "Kershaya based in Hagadol Kayam, Loi Hosah Machlokes B'Yisrael." When there was the great based in the upper court, the Supreme Court essentially, which was the Sanhedrin Hagadol, which operated in the Beis Hamikdash, there was no dispute. What does that mean? So how would it work? Let's say you live in the Upper Galilee, right? And you don't know what to do in a certain circumstance. So what do? Shoel the Beis Din shebeiroi im yadu amrulai im lav hareze shoel im oisai Beis Din. So let's say that he goes to his local Beis Din of how many people would probably be in that Beis Din? 3, right? So the local Beis Din in the upper Galilee, let's say, you know, he went to the Netofah Beis Din, right? So, and they say, if they looked in the books, if there was an answer, they would tell him. If not, they would say, well, we need to consult. So they would send an emissary, they would send an email to Jerusalem. So there was 3 Bate Dinim in Yerushalayim. There was 1 by Har Abayis, there was 1 by the entrance of the Beis Hamikdash. These were smaller, each one of 3. If not, then let's say the hardest questions, the Supreme Court cases, right, the real defining vehicle cases which are going to affect the future of all law in Israel, they would come to the Supreme Court, to the Sanhedrin, with the Shalom, they would ask, Im hoyo hadavar shenoled mosofek lakol, yodua etzel beisin lagodol, bemi pi kabola, bemi pi amida shedonu boya omrim amiyad. If this is part of the Torah Shebaal Peh, which was a tradition or a development, right, the Rambam is referring to those two different silos of Torah Shebaal Peh, then they would answer if it was known, Im lav, im loy hoyo hadavar kain, borur etzel beisin lagodol, but donin boy v'shaaton, v'noisin v'noisin v'dovar, ad shiyiskemu kulon. They would discuss this matter until there was consensus, or yamdu l'minyan, or they'd have to go to a vote. V'yelchu achar harov, and they would follow the majority opinion. V'yamru l'kol ha'shalim kach halacha v'hol chinohen, and that's how halacha was decided. So therefore, there could have been a dispute in court, but there was no dispute after court, because once the court gave a ruling, that was the ruling, and that decision was rendered for all of the umbrella Bate Dinim across the land of Israel. So therefore, in a future situation which matched this case, they would apply the din which was there. Which means to say, all the dispute that we're talking about in the Gemara and the Mishnah is post-based in Agadol. So just for sake of intellectual clarity then, so that means to say that for the time of the first Beis Hamikdash and the second Beis Hamikdash, the vast majority of the second Beis Hamikdash, there was no dispute between as to the major practices. There may have been sectarianism, so there may have been split off groups from we'll call it mainstream traditional Judaism, as there was at the end of the Second Beis Hamikdash. So there were all kinds of different factions. But in terms of the Purushim, in terms of traditional Judaism, there was no dispute as to what the practice was. It wasn't that there was even a lechatchila and bedieved. Right? Where did the terms lechatchila and bedieved even come from? That is a later day application of a dispute, essentially, right? So when you have two valid opinions, it's important to know that they're valid opinions of equal standing, and there's a dispute and the dispute remains unresolved, then sometimes in halacha that turns into lecharchila and bedieved, which is a sort of gray zone. You should really be doing A, and if you don't do A, you can rely on B. That means to say there was a dispute, right? That it's usually based on dispute, which is where lecharchila and bedieved. There was no lecharchila and bedieved in the times of Beis Hamikdash. It was, you do this, and that's it. Because it was voted on. Every dispute was had in court, not in the streets, not at the Shabbos table, and it was voted upon, and that became the halacha. In a certain sense today, I find it interesting, is to a large degree, it's interesting to look at Chabad, because Chabad is very monolithic about its psak, because they only really have one stream of psak, the Shulchan Aruch Harav. And so when it comes to that, there's no disputes that you find sort of in the Mishnah Berurah with all kinds of complexities and so on. It's very sort of monolithic, and that's it, and there's only one way in all the highway. That kind of thing, but even to a larger degree, was the way it was. And that's why, like, sort of all Chabad do the same thing, right? There's all just the same course of action. In Klal Yisrael, that's how it used to be for everything. Everything was one course of action in terms of this because of the base that I got. So when we talk about dispute, we're talking about dispute post Sanhedrin HaGadol, which means to say in the last 2,000 years. That sounds like a long time, but you have to realize that for 1,000 years before that, there was less dispute in terms of practice. There was certainly dispute and argument about political sovereignty. So as an example, in the first Beis Hamikdash, the kingdom split into two. Right? So that was a dispute. That wasn't a dispute about practice. That was a political, so to speak, egotistical expansion of a grab for power. But within the Judean kingdom, it was very clear as to what should have been done at times. There were sometimes disputes between the king and the Navi. And it's worthwhile looking at some of those interesting disputes over there, but usually it was a way of resolving those, not for now. Okay, so that's in terms of how dispute was resolved at those times. So you say, okay, so then when did machloikas, as we see it, because you can barely get through any folio, any daf of the Gemara without a machloikas. So if that's all post-based in Agadol, so what was the first machloikas that we can record? And the answer is actually it's recorded very clearly in the Mishnah, the first machloikas that was preserved, meaning machloikas is endemic. We all argue. But machloikas in terms of normative practice that was preserved and not voted on, which is the earliest one we can point a finger to? Anybody familiar? Good. Excellent, Paul. So the first argument has to relate to smicha. Not smicha as we call it, as we did today in terms of rabbinic tradition, but smicha when it comes to a korban. The machloikas is, and take a look at this very beautiful Mishnah. It passes us by, but we don't realize the significance of this Mishnah in Source 5. The Mishnah says that Yosef ben Yoezer, in Chagiga, the second parak, second Mishnah, Yosef ben Yoezer, Amer Shalal Lismach, Yosef ben Yochanan, Amer Lismach, Yosef ben Prachi, Amer Shalal Lismach, Nitar Abeli, Amer Lismach, Yehuda ben Tabai, Amer Shalal Lismach, Shem ben Shadach, Amer Shalal Lismach, Shmai ben Amer Lismach, Atalin, Amer Shalal Lismach, Hillel Menachem, Lo Nechlakus, Hillel Menachem never argued, Yotz Menachem, Nichnas Shammai, so apparently Menachem disappeared, in enters Shammai, and Shammai Omer Shalal Yismach, and the argument continued. Why are these 10 or 11 people so significant? Why are those names significant to us in this Mishnah? So these are not Tanaim. These are not the sages of the Mishnah. These are proto-Tanaim. What does that mean? These are what we call, if you read the first parak of Pirkei Avos, Zugos. Right? This is when there was centralized Torah leadership in Israel before the Mishnah, the leaders of the Mishnah. This is all pre-destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. These were the leaders of the times. Do you really know what their titles were, each of these groups of two? The one was the Nasi, who was sitting in the presidium, he was the president, and the other one was the Av Beis Din, the head of the Beis Din. They were the two leaders of the community. And this was maintained for five generations. For five generations, the centralized leadership was to the Nasi and the Av Beis Din. And we read them in Pirkei Avos who the names are. There's Yosei and Yosei, right? Those are the first two. Then there's Yosheb ben Prachia and Nitzahar Beli. Then there's Yehuda ben Taba and Shimon ben Shadach, Shemaiah Vav Talion, and Hillel and Shammai. There were only 10 leaders throughout the course of these centuries because it went from Av Beis Din to Av Beis Din, Nasi to Nasi, all the way down. Here's an interesting thing, which essentially the Mishnah is telling us, is there was a machloikas which was intergenerational at the time of the Sanhedrin. There was a Sanhedrin active over here, and therefore it should have been voted on. it should have been voted on, but it wasn't voted on, and they maintained this machlokes. Isn't that fascinating? This is the first machlokes that that was preserved and not voted down. Yes.
Just a question. You know, even pre that, right? We have you know, Moabit, you know, as a machlokes.
Good question. Yes.
And there are probably others that said that whatever, but in pre, that wasn't settled until much, you know, that probably was preserved over time, and then was only settled at a certain period of time. You know, so is that included at all in this?
No, so Abi is asking a good question. We do see elements of dispute before, and so as an example, you know, David HaMelech's, you know, lineage was a matter of dispute. So Doeg HaAdami felt that David HaMelech was not fit to enjoy the Kahal because of his matrilineal descent. And then it was the Gemara tells us that it was settled, and you know, and David HaMelech began David HaMelech. So I think those kind of things may be maybe an expression of a question of Misara, question of tradition, and that was very settled very quickly. So it wasn't a dispute about, you know, how we derive or how we expand this rule. It was what's actually the truth in this case, and that was settled very very clearly in the base measure at that time. So I think those are more right. Based on Shmuel. So but the point is that there was a I think it was because of miscommunication or an ego and miscommunication in the case of Doeg HaAdami, which was later clarified, as opposed to two sages arguing about the idea as well. Yes, Yossi.
Talking about trying to figure out what God's will is, and the decision is based on human beings having an argument and deciding who's in the robe and who's not in the robe, and that is God's will.
It's such a very good question. I think this is the most humbling, the humbling divine act, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's willingness to give over the keys to the Torah to human beings. It's the most humbling thing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did. It reflects even the creation of the human being. Where, as Rashi quotes, he asks the Malachi Asharis about the creation of human beings. Why does Hashem need permission from the Malachi Asharis? He created them. And yet, in this incredible, you know, sweep of humility, he gives over the keys to human beings who are going to quibble, who are going to argue, who are going to deride, who are going to misunderstand, who are going to chepper each other. And ultimately, he gave the rules of how to resolve that as well. Acher Rabbim Nahatos is a divine command. So he wrote that in the Torah, trying to be able to steward us in the right direction. Right, and so one has to question mistakes, which we'll do next time, God willing, in the realm of authority, is how do we deal with mistakes in this? But if you think about that from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's perspective, it's the most remarkable. He made us a shareholder in the posterity of his Ratzon. That's unbelievable, which means to say that throughout the course of history, he trusted us enough with the responsibility of us to make intellectually honest decisions and situations. Sometimes we make mistakes. But to get to that, that's, by the way, why that whole machlokas of Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim and Acharei Rabbim Nahatos, Rabbi Eliezer may have been right intellectually and corrected from we'll call it objective perspective. In the end of the day, that's not the way the rules that Hashem gave us to interact with Halacha. So you have to see the Tanur Shel Achnai situation. Your question to me is just the most, you know, I would say earth-shattering idea of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu trusts us in this relationship. But let's dig this a little bit deeper over here, because we have this moment of so to speak voting, where everything is voted in and there's one system. And then afterwards we see this expansion of dispute which is unresolved, but there's one dispute which is already preserved all the way through. Why is it preserved all the way through? This is an important thing to be aware of. Many of the later Svarim talk about this. The Mishnah Eretz Yisrael, and this Mishnah says a very interesting thing. I think it is a beautiful observation. Is that there's two values at stake. The dispute is about whether you do smicha on Yom Tov. That means to say you bring a korban to the Beis Hamikdash. Smicha is when the owner places their hands and says whether it's a korban which a person needs vidui on, that would be a sin offering, or it might not be. It might be a shlamim, it might be a korban ru'iyah. Other korban is brought to the Beis Hamikdash, and the owner would place their hands on this korban before it was shechted. And in a certain sense, the dispute over here in this Mishnah is as to whether a korban tzibur, that means a communal offering, requires smicha or not. And from the ideological perspective, the argument is such, is how much of a role do we as regular proletariats have in the communal offerings? The Kohanim did everything, right? And the power of the Kohanim was something which became more and more complicated and dangerous as the second Beis Hamikdash proceeded, because they took too much power. They took kingship and priesthood, right, under the Chashmonaim, right, Yochanan Hurkunis, and that was a very complicated time in the second Beis Hamikdash. And this dispute, which was happening at the same time, was essentially arguing, is how much does an individual have the rights in a sacrifice itself. Is a korban simul, do we have hands in that? Do we have a place in that? Or is it completely devoid of us and the Kohanim do everything? And it was such a significant, we'll call ideological battle, that they didn't even vote on this. In fact, the Margolios Hayom argues that the Nasi was not a voting party in the Sanhedrin, but he had veto power. Think about that, what that means for a moment. Think what that means. Is that brilliant to think what this means? So why was the Machlokes preserved? Because the Nasi and Av Beis Din were in argument. He couldn't vote, but he disputed ideologically, and so it never came to the table. It was sort of the two arms of wings of halachic development, which were essentially in check with each other, keeping each other in check, and ideologically each side deserved to remain in stasis.
What did they do for 2,000 years?
Okay. That's a great question. Exactly. I guess it depended who was in charge. That's the question. Is how does normative practice relate to a dispute? And you see this numerous times as well. Afterwards, there'll be disputes as to what did the tzitz say? What did they do? Right, is a question. So there's so many machloikesim like this. But let's take this a little further. So the question is why did they preserve? Why did machloikes develop to the point that they stopped voting? Why did they not just clarify everything and make it monolithic? And there's one system of practice, and there's no black and white and grays. Why did that happen? So there's four arguments as to this. Many, many. But there's four possibilities as to why this can be. The first is based on the Tosefta, is that when the Sanhedrin ceased to operate, that's of course when Machlokes happened, because there was no voting and there was no centralized authority which said this is the way Machlokes should be. So therefore it started burgeoning in such a way that every town had to make their own decisions. And as every town started making their own decisions, disputes arose, and great sages of different areas would dispute certain things. So you start seeing this in the first century, the second century common era. You start seeing practices developing in different towns which were different. As an example, Rabbi Eliezer felt that he, based on his halachic principles, that machshire mila doichin es haShabbos, that you could prepare, you could cut down the wood to make the fire, to melt the metal, to make the knife, to do bris milah on Shabbos, because mila is doichin Shabbos. Now the majority of the chachamim didn't agree on this. We were just talking about this beforehand. So what happened? In the city of Rabbi Eliezer, that's where they did what he practiced, but that, so to speak, got phased out. But there was no centralized or voting authority. They'd voted on this specifically. So it became more complicated. So the first thing was the recession of the Beis Din HaGadol. By the way, the Beis Din HaGadol was not stopped. It stopped itself. The Beis Din HaGadol, the Gemara tells us, stopped rendering decisions 40 years prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Which means that, and why? The Gemara says, Mishirabu Roitzchen, there was so much murder going on in society that they stopped operating, which is counterintuitive. You say, no, so now they should operate, set up a satellite, right? You know, have the quick line, the easy pass, and they didn't. That because they were not simply to keep society into check, they were trying to render God's ratzon in society, and they felt that in a situation where anarchy was developing, they were no longer going to be necessary, which is fascinating. So they removed themselves. Yes?
So there are certain concepts that think would be pretty basic. For example, tefillin, people were wearing tefillin since Matan Torah.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, 1,000 years ago, there's an argument about what the tefillin are and what the order of parsha. What were people doing for 2,000 years?
Such a good question. Rashi Rabbeinu Tam, what is happening with these? There has to have been a practice. It's a very good question, and I don't fully appreciate the answer, but there are many questions like this. Most, just to clarify this, and just this is where it becomes, so to speak, broad strokes. People say, everything's a dispute. No. Everything that's written in the tefillin is clear. The shape of the tefillin, the color of the tefillin, everything is clarified. One little detail is of dispute. What actually happened is a matter of great discussion, and I don't know the full answer. But the one basic reason over here is that the Beis Din HaGadol said, okay, we're taking a step backwards, and then dispute expanded. Another option is that the Gemara in Sota tells us that it was because the words that it uses is Mishirabu Mekable Matonos. No, that's not the right over here. Mishirabu Zechuche Halev Rabu Machlokes. When the boastful hearts proliferated, that's when dispute increased. Mishirabu Talmid Shamai Vihilel Shaloi Shimshu Kol Tzarchon Rabu Machlokes B'Yisrael, when the students weren't doing the necessary shimush, they weren't listening properly 100%, that's when Machlokes developed. At the times of Hillel and Shammah, which was the end of the Zugos, which is when the Sanhedrin was disappearing, that was the end of the second Beis HaMikdash. So students, that's when, meaning to say, it was a infidelity in the intellectual progress of the students which led to machlokes, because there was no longer, so to speak, this willingness to work together was limited. It's interesting, because isn't that interesting that the last time the Mishnah in Abba says that it was a machlokes l'shem shamayim was Hillel and Shammai, not Talmidei Hillel and Shammai. What the Mishnah is essentially doing is putting a limit on when machlokes l'shem shamayim ended. That's essentially what the Mishnah is trying to say, just based on this Gemara. Third possibility is it could be a Naksuri, like you mentioned last week, is once they wrote down the Torah Shebaal Peh, that's when there was a great amount of machlokes, because once you write it down, you lose, you sacrifice so much. Yes, there's a great amount of sacrifice necessary when you write it down, because there's going to be misinterpretation. There's going to be differences of perspective just by the fact you write it down. And finally, in the introduction of Rav Levin to Rav Shirira Gaon, he argues that it is because of mistakes which crept in, because of tradition, because of what was happening in exile. At this critical moment in exile, there was a lot of problems happening, and people without them, so to speak, mistakes in tradition happened to the point that there was dispute as to what was going on. So various different reasons as to why we start seeing the problems emerging, not problems, but machloikas in general proliferating.
Doesn't it answer Yossi's question?
To a certain degree, yeah, but one would like to think there's more than that, which we'll come back to. Because you're right, we could relegate it to that. But that it's interesting to note that in general, since the time of the Sanhedrin Agadol, there seems to be a pattern in Jewish history, which is a pattern that I would call consolidation and expansion of Torah thought. What does that mean? There's moments in time where individuals or groups of individuals got together and said, we need to consolidate all the dispute and division and write down a corpus of material which will be for all of Israel. So who's the first one who did that? That is a watershed moment. Rabbi Yehuda Abanasi was the author of the Mishnah, who essentially says we need all of these disputes being had across different countries now as we're about to go into further exile to be closed. Who's the next watershed moment of, so to speak, consolidation after expansion? Ravina and Rav Ashi, around the year 500, where they're closing the Gemara, and the closing the Gemara itself is a fascinating discussion. Read Rabbi Dr. Bergman's doctoral thesis, fascinating discussion in general about the closing of the Gemara. And then when was the next real watershed moment of, we will call it, consolidation of lots of disputes?
The Rambam.
The Rambam in Mishneh Torah writes, and listen to his language in Source 10. He says, "Vizman hazeh," in Source 10, "shetokfu tzaros yeseros," that there are so many persecutions. Remember, the Rambam fled as a teenager from Spain under, at that point in time, a very fanatic fundamentalist Muslim group. Later on, it was going to be the fundamentalist Christians, but at this point, it was the fundamentalist Muslims. And he fled to North Africa, then to Israel, and then to Egypt. Right? So he wrote under the run. He says, at the time, there's so much pressure now. And the wisdom of our sages is actively being lost. All the response and all the leadership of the Gaonim, which is a 600-year period from the times of the closing of the Gemara until the time that the Rambam is living, about how they led the communities in Babylon, Iraq, and Israel is disappearing. Nobody really understands why his access to them. To study the Gemara, you need a lot of work. It's not so easy. Going to the next paragraph, he says, because of this, Na'arti Chotzni, Ani Moshe, Beribi, and Maimon Asfaradi, I, Rabbi Moshe, son of Maimon of Spain, Venishanti Alatsur Baruchu, Ubinosi Bukholel Asrem, I researched all of these books for you. He says, "Vareisi lechaber dvarim amis barerim mikol elu achiburim binyana asur v'amuta v'tomei atohar imshar dinei Torah kulam beloshon berura v'derech kitzara." I now put it all together into 14 books into the new halachic system. By the way, he got very highly criticized for doing this because he changed the methodology of teaching. But what he essentially was doing is he was consolidating. Why? What stimulated him to this? To do this is he felt that things were being lost. The expansion was too far. In Nisparda Chavila, the falcon can no longer hear the falconer. This is all falling apart, says the Rambam. I'm going to put it together. And again, one more critical time in Jewish history where consolidation happens, and that is the Shulchan Aruch, where the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama pulled together essentially all of Halacha into one place, and of course it expanded afterwards, the Nosei Kalim and all the Machloikas and so on and so forth, and expanded outwards. But if you think about Jewish history as a pattern, in a, we'll call it post-Sanhedrin world, essentially the pattern would look like expansion, consolidation, expansion, consolidation, expansion, consolidation. That seems to be it. And what is the stimulating principle? What brings about a consolidation moment? It seems to be Tokvu HaTzoras' preservation is where there seems to be this drive to create a monolithic idea. Hang on for a second. Let's drive this a little further. Okay? So you say, okay. So let's just dig a little bit deeper into Machloekas. So historically speaking, this is at least Chazal speaking, why it is that this is happening. So you say, well, let's sort of hone in on Machloekas itself. Is there anything positive, or is it simply a miscommunication of the ages? So I remember when I once read If Not Now, When? By Primo Levi. Anybody had a chance to read any of Primo Levi's books? Yes? Fantastic, good. I find them personally pretty depressing. He's a very, very hard look at reality. And he, one of his books, If Not Now, When, is actually focusing on partisans, and they're in the forest, and this odd group of folks who sort of come together. And one night around the absent campfire, they're busy talking about philosophy, and they start talking about the Gemara, the Talmud. And this is the description of one of them to the other. And I always remember this as such a misguided description of Talmud. So I wanted to use it as our foil for a moment. So here's the description. He says, Pavel interrupted. I'll explain what the Talmud is to you with an example. Now listen carefully. Two chimney sweeps fall down in the flue of a chimney. One comes out covered with soot, the other one comes out clean. Which of the two goes to wash himself? Suspecting a trap, Piotr looked around as if seeking help. Then he plucked up the courage and answered, the one who's dirty goes to wash. Wrong, said Pavel. The one who's dirty sees the other man's face and it's clean, so he thinks it's clean too. Instead, the clean one with soot sees the soot on the other one's face, believes he is dirty himself and goes to wash. You understand? I understand. That makes sense. But wait, I haven't finished the example. Now I'll ask you a second question. Two chimney sweeps fall into a second time in the same flue. One is dirty and the other one isn't. Which one goes to wash? I don't understand. The clean one goes to wash. Wrong, says Pavel mercilessly. When the washed one after the first wolf, the clean man saw that the water in his basin didn't get dirty, and the dirty man realized why the clean man had gone to wash, so this time the dirty man chimney sweep went and washed. Piotr listened to this and with the mouth open, half in fright and half in curiosity. And now the third question. The pair falls down the flue a third time. Which of the two goes to wash? For now, the dirty one will go to wash. Wrong again. Did you ever hear of two men falling down the same flue and one remaining clean and the other one dirty? There, that's what the Talmud is like. Right? So that's sort of this, you know, the disconnected, uneducated Jew who had obviously clearly had, you know, one bad encounter with Talmud in his cheder, and then went off to the workforce and is no longer, you know, that's the sort of that perspective. And they're just all, it's all senselessness. So, like, what's really going on when it comes to dispute? So it is so much more than this misguided perspective. And this is the perspective you sort of hear this type of language. You hear this type of perspective on dispute all the time when it comes to what we'll call the world outside. That looks in on us. So the Gemara actually describes this and relates very, and I say, in a very frank and intellectually honest way to argument. It's based on a pasuk in Qoheles. The pasuk is at the very end, and Qoheles is coming to his crescendo. He says, Divrei chachomim kedar vonos. The sayings of the wise are like goads, and we're not going to focus on that part right now, maybe next week. Like nails fixing in prodding sticks, given by one shepherd. Bale Asuf was the people in gatherings which were given by one shepherd. So the Gemara says the following. It asks it says the following observation in Chagiga Gimel Beis. Bale Asuf was Elu Talmid Echachamim Shioshim Asuf was Oseben Gatara. That sages or people, and it's a meritocracy, everybody can do this. We all get together, we try to study together, try to understand what's going on. Halalu matamim v'halalu matarim, halalu oimrim oistrim v'halalu matrim, halalu poistrim v'halalu machshir. And you have just different opinions as to what to do in a given situation. So the Gemara asks the question that we all ask, which is, Shema yomar adam, heyach ani lame torah me'atad. Why am I learning? It's all a dispute. Says the Gemara, Talmud lomar kulam nitnu miroi echad. The pasuk concludes they were all given from one shepherd. Keil echad nosnam. That all these matters were given. So the dispute, in a certain sense, what the Gemara is saying is a contradictory idea, which is what? That all the matters of dispute were given from God. You're also coming back to your point. So, but I don't understand. There's two people sitting around a table here. They come up with an opposite conclusion. This one says Tomei, this one says Tahar. You say, how am I supposed to learn Torah? The Gemara is saying that really they're Meroyei Echa. They come from one shepherd. But it can't be. God can't, it has to be binary. The action has to be black or white. It can't be, you know, this quantum principle of standing at the same time on two levels. This is what the Gemara ultimately says in Eruvin Daf Yud Gimel, is what's called the notion of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. These and these are the words of the living God, which is a hard concept to understand. What does that mean? Is surely truth is objective, and if truth is objective, that means to say it's mutually exclusive to other opinions. You don't have the right to a postmodern narrative in the face of truth. Right, so and today everybody has a truth, right? Everybody's entitled to an opinion, right? If you're looking at the news right now, you know it's equally as plausible. It sounds like that, you know, that these black Hebrews supplanted the Jews, right? That's just not true. That's objectively incorrect. It's not a narrative. You don't have that opinion. It doesn't exist. So how could it be that the Torah is saying that when you see a dispute, somehow it all comes back to Hashem? This is the question. There's obviously something bigger in dispute than simply miscommunications after the post Migdash, post Sanhedrin era. If it's all right, I just want to just do a little bit of further because of the timing. So there are a number of suggestions as to what this could mean. Two, which I think are incredibly meaningful. One is the Ritva. The Ritva, who's one of the medieval commentators, the Rishonim on the Gemara itself, says Elu Elu V'dira Elokim Chaim in source 15. How could it be? It's opposites. When Moshe Rabbeinu ascended Har Sinai, Heru lo yes kol ha-davar, va-davar, mimtes panim le-isra, mimtes panim le-heter, v'shol ha-kodesh baruch hu al-zeh. So Hashem displayed in every concept 49 perspectives of heter, 49 perspectives of isra, and he asked Hashem, v'amar, she'ezeh masur l'chachmei yisrael she'bechol davar davar, yachra k'moysam. So in the complexity of real issues, not monolithic issues, real issues, there are multiple sides on the right side, multiple sides on the left side, and he gave it to the Chachmei HaMasorah to find and to emphasize and to unpack them. Which means, if you think about what he's essentially saying, this is a very beautiful concept, is that when you have a dispute about a particular given issue, then essentially both sides are actually really reflecting a certain facet of a complex issue, right? So the famous example that's used for this is it goes back to various different traditions, but it's very helpful in this is about four people who are, you know, who don't come from Asia or Africa, and they're brought into the room with this new creature called an elephant, but they're blindfolded. And they're asked to give a description of what this creature is. And the four people walk out this room afterwards, and they, you know, give a pat down. And the first one says, "An elephant is clearly like a tree." And the other one says, "An elephant is like a brick wall." And the other one says, "The elephant is like a rope." And the other one says, "The elephant is like a hose pipe." So it says, "Well, what do these guys go in the same room?" The answer is yes. The one was holding the leg. The one was patting the stomach. The one was holding the tail. And the other one was holding the trunk. So are they wrong? The answer is they're all right, but they're right about different parts of the truth that they're relating to. And that's the same over here, what the Ritva says. At Har Sinai, Hashem gave exceptionally complex, multifaceted ideas. And over the time of history, of the course of history, in a real, intellectually honest debate, multiple facets would be expressed. It's important for us to, if we had this idea in politics today, can you imagine? There'd be real discussion. On a lot of the issues that are policy that we're voting on today, they're not black and white. Red or blue, they're complex. There's multiple, you know, you have to have normative practice, but the issues are complex. It's not so simple that it's always right and always wrong. And that's what's being said over here, is that there was a divine will for us to unpack those. So therefore, in the process of debate is the expression of those separate ideas as well. That's what Rav Kook says in his letters. He talks about this expansion of completion, which is to be found when people come together in trying to find this. Another perspective on this, and I think this is a very beautiful idea, is actually the Torah Tamimah. The Torah Tamimah says it's not about this we'll call divine idea being revealed in a complex way. He says that if you look at source 17, he says Nira Kavana. What does it mean? Nivnesha called Devara Yotze Mipi Hashem Eino Echad Eino Barur Kolkak Yachol Yos Shogeg V'Toa. If you have something which comes simply from one person, then it's not going to be that person, it's not going to be 100% true. Why? Because he made a mistake. Ma she'enken davar yotzei me'asifas chachamim hu chazak ve'eitan k'moy natua b'masmerim. Something which has been tried and tested in peer review is much more significant than something which is simply the product of one brilliant individual. And I remember when I had my bar mitzvah, my bar mitzvah was Parshas Chukas, and so I was trained with my bar mitzvah teacher, of course, knew it all over heart. Comes the next year, and guess what? It was Parshas Chukas Balak. And so, of course, fearless 14-year-old gets up there and says, of course, I'll do that. So into the first aliyah of Balak, at a certain point, the rabbi of Marshall, who was based in South Africa, Rabbi Kurtzag, who is, you know, six foot something, and he gets up and he made an announcement, and he says, I'm going to be the only one to correct him right now. That's how bad it was. Why? Because when you train by yourself, you train your mistakes inward. If you don't have an auditor, you train and you keep repeating and learning your same mistakes. No matter how brilliant you may be, if you don't have an external audit, you're going to learn your mistakes. And that's what the Torah member says. Why is Elu ve'elu ekle divrei Elokim chayim? Is because it allows the ideas to be tried and tested by multiple different and complex minds who will fight, argue, and hammer out until we get to the refined product. Therefore, that's what it is. It's not about each of them having a specific truth as much as it is it's the peer tested, the peer review of the whole experience as well. That is what the Torah Tamimah says. So you say, okay, this all may be very nice in terms of the process of Machlokes and the development and the necessary development, the humbling development of Halacha, as you described it. But at the end of the day, so what do we do? So in a post-Migdash reality, in a post-Sanhedrin reality, which is almost synonymous, not 100% because of the timing, but in a post-Sanhedrin reality, so what precisely do we do about this? So there are rules, which we'll discuss, God willing, next week in terms of this, but there is an important overarching principle, and with this we'll conclude. And that is, says the Maharal in Be'er HaGola, he says in the bottom of page 6, source 18, where he says, by the underline, she'af im adavar tomei, iyo shar shelo yetzad b'china el tohara shalma. Even if something seems to be completely impure, there must be something in it which is pure as well. V'chein im adavar tohor, iyo shar shelo yiyah b'loi b'china ma shel tumah, u'b'nei adam mechulakim b'seichel, v'iyo shar shiyukol echad b'nei adam al derech echad. It can't be that everybody agrees. In fact, that's just the nature of it. To the next paragraph, rak. When you want to know what to do, when it comes to halacha, we have to say that we have to give weight to one opinion over the other opinion. Even if it's a complex matter, so the Maharal says it may be true that there are multiple facets, but in the end of the day, we need normative practice. And therefore, we have to have a way of resolving this. And so, therefore, there are what's called klalei apsak through the ages in the times of the Mishnah. It's Rabbi Akiva mechaveroi, not mechaverov. Right? There's rules as to which sages we go in which direction. And in the Gemara, there are the rules. And in the post-Gemara, there are rules as to how we resolve disputes. And it goes all the way through how the Shulchan Aruch phrases his Yesh Omrims. Is a default and then Yesh Omrim, or Yesh Omrim and then a default to Yesh Omrims. There are rules as to what's called klalei apsak, how we get to this. Which means to say that we have to live in this tension of knowing that there could be truth to both opinions, but there has to be one way to act. Right? And there's rules as how to do that. Racha Rabbi Nahatos was in the times of the Sanhedrin, and there's more complexity when it comes to the post-Sanhedrin rule. Rav Schechter points out, and he has a beautiful article on Elu Ve'elu, where he says that we have to be careful with this, you see, because we aren't the experts necessarily all the time to know the difference between those two. Sometimes what we do is we give too much credence. You know, somebody once said to me, I did research on the internet, and there was a rabbi who looked rabbinic enough to have an opinion, and so it seems like it wasn't a problem to do X, so we did it. And I'm like, you know, I don't know if that's the way I would break Yom Tov necessarily myself. But what Rav Schechter points out is that not all opinions necessarily even warranted to be in this space, which means that you don't say Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim to things that were voted down and excluded from the Masorah, as an example. So Rav Schechter points out here He says this concept does not always apply in cases. Rashi and Tosfos talk about where, let's say, an idea is against a predominant idea in the Gemara or against a pasuk. That is not an opinion. That opinion becomes voted out, and it doesn't exist as an opinion to even be a yesh al ma lismach opinion as well. In Rav Shechter, in fact, talks about an example where just this last week, actually, Rav Shechter was in town with Rav Amar at the end of the Smichas Chaveh program, and somebody asked a very pointed question. They said, Rav Shechter, in so many of your Piskei Corona, during Corona, when you gave so much guidance to the community, you relied on a principle which was called Shas Adachak Kibidievedomi, that in a time of difficulty, we treat it like a bidieved, and you can rely on an opinion you wouldn't usually rely on. But yet, when it came to making minyanim on porches, do you remember this? There was a time just before this Shavuos where it was illegal to have 10 people together, but people saying, well, let's make minyanim on different porches or properties, right? And Rav Shechter very clearly came out against it. In fact, well, I was there when I was involved in bringing the Rabbanim of the community together to ask these very complicated questions. Rav Shechter says you cannot do that because there's a problem of is there tziruf between different houses and over the streets and the distance between properties here in suburbia. And so he says, but why didn't you rely on the Rashba? The Rashba says, you can, as long as you can see. That's sufficient. You know what Rav Shechter said? He says, because the Rashba was voted out of halacha. If you read the Rishonim, all of the Rishonim treat the Rashba as neglected on the side of history. So us, as a proletariat, we can search, research, and find the Rashba. But the Rav Shechter says that Rashba did not make it into mainstream halacha as being even a part of the Elu Ve'elu, as part of the halachic process. But that's why we have to ask somebody who has that capacity to know what makes it and what doesn't make it. And Rav Shechter wasn't saying this because he was responding to what was happening in Corona. It's because that's the precise way that halacha works. It's really important to know this. And that's why somebody on the outside, probably somebody unschooled perhaps, might miss this, which is why we need to have the intellectual honesty to ask this. I'd like to conclude with the following teaching and then and story. And this is the observation that Rakuk makes. Rakuk quotes the pasuk, which is based on the Gemara expands. Kol bonaych limudei Hashem v'Rav Shalom bonaych. Rabbi Elazar says, Talmidei Chachamim marbim shalom ba'olam, that the sages brings the peace to the world. And you say to yourself, really, peace? They're arguing all the time. Every 2 minutes, every daf of Gemara, they're arguing. That's not really peaceful. That's a lot of dispute. So Rav Kook says that we're reading the word incorrectly. Shalom doesn't mean to say kumbaya, we're all around the campfire and we're all singing together. He says that shalom means a notion of shlemus. Shlemus means that when you have complex issues, if it's only monolithic, then there's no way to arrive at real shlemus. Shlemus is when multiple people are giving multiple angles at the same issue. Then you come to the more complex and real outcome of what an issue is. Most real values in our life are intention. There's no such thing as only one right way when it comes to complex issues. And therefore he says, it's not Gadol Shalom Banaich, it's Rav Shalom Banaich. When there's multiple perspectives, that's when you arrive at truth. The respect to know, first of all, you have to be qualified to have an opinion. But those who are qualified to have an opinion, when they sit around the table and they render opinions, all those disputing opinions help give us the more holistic perspective of what that is. So machlokes, not just as a historical outcome of a miscommunication, but as perhaps the process that Hashem allowed us through to try to develop ideas to the greater being. It's worthwhile knowing how far this goes. When the Gera Rebbe started buying land in the land in Israel, he saw what was happening in Europe and he felt that it was time to buy in Israel. This is very criticized at the time. Because remember, aligning oneself with the Zionists and secular Zionists was seen so much so that the Naturi character burnt an effigy of the Gera Rebbe at the time. So Ad Kedei Kach. And then when they reported this to the Gera Rebbe laughed and he says that if they had not burnt an effigy of himself, he would have organized a group to have done it. What does he mean? So it comes down to and I'll close with the story because we're now out of time. But the story is about a king who has a very precious treasure, and he decides that he's going to put it into a place where it could be impenetrable. So what does he do? He places it in the recesses of one of his most his strongest fortresses, which happens to be embedded in a deep and dark forest along the side of his kingdom. But he gets the best and the finest of all his military and police experts who are going to be manning this. So he takes all the best of all the divisions and he places them on the ramparts of this castle and he has them guard it. But it turns out that in this forest, from time immemorial have been a band of thieves. And these band of thieves are highwaymen who rob anybody who passes through the forest. And they hear about the fact that the king's treasure has been placed in this palace. So what do? So that they spend a few months just listening. They're just surveillance. So they see when the change of guards happen. They see who's in charge where. Are there any weaknesses? Are there any access points? And what happens is that one night under surveillance, they hear from the ramparts that the guards are shouting at each other. It's the middle of the night, and there's this great argument that's going on. And this one's shouting, this one's accusing, this one's defending, and it's turning into a ruckus, and they say, this is it, this is our moment. So the thieves take the weakest point that they found, they make access to the castle, and as they enter over the ramparts, all the guards swoop down in a unified mission and capture them and arrest them. And the head of the highwayman turns to his guard as he's being pulled off in chains to the cell, and he says, I don't understand. We heard you were arguing. He says, yeah, you're right. We were arguing, but the reason why we were shouting at each other was so not to fall asleep in the dark of night in the middle of the forest, because it's very hard to maintain your place on a post all night with your night vision goggles and look into the forest for the enemy, which is never going to really appear very easily. And so we are shouting each other to keep awake. And that's what the Gerar Rebbe was really saying. The Gerar Rebbe was saying, I'm doing something which seems a bit bold in my time, as I need to have a fringe group which is going to be burning my effigy in order for me to remain in the fold. And the same thing with Chassidus. Chassidus had so many great values, but it was very dangerous. Suddenly, all kinds of things. You know, Zmanei Tefillah out the window, right? All kinds of things. Suddenly, everything, you know, new rules. And Ms. Nagner says, what are you talking about? That's not Judaism, right? There's Shulchan Aruch, right? And thank goodness for the Misnagdim who kept the Hasidim in check. And thank goodness for the Hasidim who said, wake up and start thinking and feeling again. And what about the unschooled, the people who are not the academic brilliant, who and their relationship to Judaism? And every dispute you see throughout history, certainly there's casualties. But the disputes keep us awake to allow us to hold together, to band together, to arrive at the truth at the end of history. That is the perspective with which perhaps we can see it in a moralistic perspective, despite the fact that when we're in the weeds, it becomes harder to appreciate. So, Rabbi, I know it's the end of a very long hour. Be'ezra Hashem, next week we're going to get into the realm of authority. How are the dominions of authority? How do we pass the halacha? Thank you so much for your time.